The following contains highlights of the membership meetings of the Council for National Policy, held in McLean, Virginia, April 21st through 23rd, 2005. This material may not be reproduced without the express written permission of the Council for National Policy, 10329-A, Democracy Lane, Fairfax, Virginia, 22030.
Tim, please pass on to the President our prayers and our thanks for his work. Well, we have a lot prepared for you this morning, and I'm not as good as Rebecca is very good. I guess with her charm and good looks, she keeps people moving. I'm going to have to resort to my training in the Marine Corps. So if the speaker's on and they all of a sudden disappear off the back of the stage, you'll know what that's all about. We are going to a lot of great topics this morning. Next, we're going to be talking about a new strategy for winning the war on abortion. By the way, I just read apparently a new study that shows that 100% of those who advocate for abortion are people who have already been born. Maybe they should consider that next time they enter the public debate. Well, Greg Cunningham is a former two-term member of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. Greg, I guess that makes you a recovering politician. He introduced legislation that ended the public funding of abortion in his state. He was also prime sponsor of the Abortion Control Act, which was litigated before the U.S. Supreme Court. During the first Reagan administration, he served as a political appointee in the Department of Education and later in the Office of Judicial Affairs with the U.S. Department of Justice here in Washington, D.C. Following that, he served as assistant U.S. attorney in Los Angeles. He is a retired U.S. Air Force colonel with 6 years of active duty, and he is a decorated Vietnam veteran. In 1990, he founded the Center for Bioethical Reform for the purpose of reinventing the pro-life movement by adapting principles of social reform for the application of pro-life activism. He speaks frequently on bioethical issues and the strategy and tactics of social reform, and his articles have appeared in the National Review, the American Spectator, World Magazine, and online at www.abortionno.org. We are pleased to have him come this morning and speak to us. Please welcome Mr. Greg Cunningham.
Good morning. I particularly appreciated Tim Gagline's remarks about John Bolton because I may be one of the few people in the room this morning who has the distinction of having been hired by John Bolton at the U.S. Department of Justice during the second Reagan administration when John served as Assistant Attorney General for Legislative Affairs. John Bolton was my boss. I worked with him every day. There is no more statesman-like person in government today, I believe, than John Bolton. And John Bolton is unusual in that he is a Republican who actually fights for conservative principles, and that looks odd to people. And when moderates and progressives experience a Republican who fights them, their inclination is to say, I'm being abused. When moderates and progressives are losing an argument, they do feel abused. And to paraphrase Winston Churchill, John Bolton is not one of those Republicans who is so indecisive that he's afraid to take his own side in an argument. I love the guy precisely because he is tough, precisely because he does go to the mat for what matters. And I came here this morning to tell you that we who are pro-life and are involved in pro-life activism, I think, need to take a cue from John Bolton and be a little bit tougher and a little bit more forceful in being a witness against this terrible evil of abortion. And I would like to share with you some of the kinds of things that we are doing to make that happen. And I'm going to ask, if I may, if the spotlights could be lowered just a little bit. They don't have to be turned off altogether. Some of what I'm going to say to you this morning is a little bit iconoclastic. and countercultural. But if you will bear with me and hear me out, I'm going to make what I think is a fairly convincing case for a fairly sharp departure from what has been our traditional approach to mainstream pro-life activism. And I want to begin by showing you some public opinion research data that is Worthland polling numbers that indicate that by 1998, about 7% of Americans thought abortion ought to be lawful without restriction. In the third trimester of abortion, only 15% in the second trimester, but 61% of Americans thought abortion should be lawful without restriction in the first trimester of pregnancy. And whereas public support for abortion in the second and third trimesters has been falling, public support for abortion in the first trimester has been rising. Worthland says that in 1980, only 50% of Americans supported an unrestricted right of access to abortion in the first trimester. By 1998, that number had risen to 61%. The Gallup polling organization reported in December of 2003 that 66%, fully two-thirds of the American people, now believe that abortion ought to be lawful without restriction in the first trimester of pregnancy. And those numbers are particularly problematic because the Centers for Disease Control report that 90% of abortions are performed in the first trimester of pregnancy, in the first 90 days of pregnancy. So we are winning the battle, apparently, for public opinion on abortion in the third trimester of pregnancy, when only about 1% of abortions are performed, and in the second trimester of pregnancy, when only about 9% of abortions are performed. But in the trimester where the overwhelming majority of abortions are performed, we are losing and losing badly. And if I had more time this morning, I could go into greater detail in our analysis of the public opinion research data. But to summarize this, there are two basic reasons that the American people believe abortion ought to be lawful without restriction in the first 90 days of pregnancy. And the first reason is they just don't believe the baby is a baby developmentally in the first 90 days. They think the term embryo has become synonymous with the phrase blob of tissue, and they reject the principle that the baby is developmentally entitled to rights of personhood. The baby is a total abstraction to people in the first 90 days. The mother is real. So in this contest to balance the rights of the mother vis-a-vis the rights of the baby, because the mother is real and because her plight is compelling, people tilt in her direction relative to the baby, who is very unreal to them. And it became clear to us as we looked at these data that until the human embryo and early fetus were made as real to the American people as is their perception of the baby's mother, they were going to be unwilling to grant rights of personhood to that baby. The second huge problem we have is that public perception of abortion itself in the first 90 days of pregnancy is that it may be evil, but it is at worst the lesser of two evils. They tend to see it as a somewhat benign outpatient surgical procedure, in contradistinction to their perception of the very gruesome partial birth abortion, whose public debate has persuaded them that this is an evil of such enormity that it ought to be criminalized. That's not their perception of first trimester abortion. And when you stop and think about what the pro-life movement for 32 years has endeavored to do, ultimately we want to amend the Constitution of the United States to confer rights of personhood on unborn children. And that process requires an enormous political consensus, because two-thirds of members of Congress have got to vote to approve that amendment, and then three-fourths of the state legislatures have got to vote to ratify that amendment. And the change in public opinion that's got to take place to create the political consensus required to amend the Constitution of the United States is so enormous that you don't get there until America is convinced that first trimester abortion, and this may be the most important thing I'll say to you this morning, a huge majority, a super majority of Americans have got to be persuaded that first trimester abortion is an evil of such enormity that it ought to be criminalized, that physicians ought to be imprisoned for terminating pregnancies in the first 90 days. We're not there. We're not close to being there. And we're not doing anything, truthfully, at a sort of a national level that would get us there. Now, we have decided to approach these two problems. Who is the baby is problem number one in the public mind. And problem number two is abortion an evil of sufficient enormity to justify criminalizing the act, in two separate ways. And I would like to begin this morning by showing you a brief video clip that will demonstrate some of the extraordinary new prenatal development imaging technology that is pouring out of research institutes around the world. And some of you may have seen a recent broadcast about 6 weeks ago on the National Geographic Society television cable channel, a two-hour broadcast, extraordinary new imaging technologies. But the technology I'm about to show you this morning is even more remarkable than anything you would have seen on the National Geographic channel. And if we may cue up the video, the first baby you will see is an embryo 6 weeks following fertilization. And I show you that embryo because that's about the point in gestation at which the first statistically substantial numbers of abortions begin to be performed. The imagery that you have just seen is offering us the first opportunity we've ever really had to make this baby so real that we will much better be able to convince people of its entitlement to rights of personhood. And there are some extraordinary projects in the works that are sensitive enough that I'm not going to talk about them right now, but I'd be glad to discuss them with you individually if you're interested in knowing about them related to this sort of imagery and what's going to be happening to get this imagery into the public mind. But let me shift gears and talk about the second problem we face, and that's the problem of convincing the American people that first trimester abortion is an evil of sufficient enormity to justify imprisoning physicians for terminating pregnancies during that period. The pro-life movement began to lose this battle at the point at which we allowed the other side to define this question as an issue of choice. Because choice is a debate that we lose. The American people venerate the concept of choice. And our focus as an organization has been to recast this debate by forcing the American people not to think about abortion in terms of choice, but to think about abortion in terms of what's being chosen. Because what's being chosen is an indefensible act of violence, which if we allow to remain an abstraction, is very, very easy for people to sort of underestimate. It's very easy for people to imagine is a great deal less evil than it actually is. I'm going to show you some of the imagery that we are using to have the impact on public opinion regarding abortion that's necessary to create the political consensus required to build these supermajorities necessary to amend the Constitution of the United States. And I will caution you, the imagery I'm about to show you is very disturbing. And we don't want to ambush anybody. If you think it's something you should not see, I invite you to simply look away from the screen. But I'm going to urge you to look at this, and I'm actually going to pray that you look at it, because I think one of the problems we face as pro-life Christian conservatives is that not all of us are as disturbed about abortion as we need to be. Not all of us are as sickened as we need to be. And I well understand people's aversion to getting this imagery in their heads, but I fervently believe that if we can't face this, we can't fight it. So if you'll indulge me for just a few moments, I'm going to show you what abortion is and does using imagery on which we rely to have the sort of impact on public opinion that we think is necessary to create the requisite political consensus. As horrifying as what we just saw is, it is far less horrifying than the perception the average American has of first trimester abortion, and yet the conventional wisdom among many pro-life leaders in America today is that the most effective way to fight abortion is to cover up the horror that it represents, to suppress the most convincing evidence we have that abortion is an evil of sufficient enormity to justify criminalizing the act when committed in the first 90 days of pregnancy. That is not our point of view, and we have begun to confront the culture with this evidence in terms that make abortion impossible to ignore and impossible to trivialize. And we have begun to go on to university campuses across the country with photo murals of the sort that you're seeing, juxtaposing aborted baby imagery next to iconic images of injustice that social reformers have traditionally used for more than a century in this country to make injustice impossible to ignore or trivialize, and to dramatize that injustice using very shocking imagery. These photo murals are 6 feet tall. They're 13 feet long. If I may have the next slide, which I just realized I will only get if I push the button. But we go on to university campuses because much of the future leadership of our country funnels through our university system every 4 years. And in terms of age, university students are in the heart of the demographic that is terminating pregnancies. We think it's absolutely critical that they receive the countervailing perspective on abortion. And these students are very sort of relativistic morally. But if they see the picture on the left, they respond with revulsion. They say this is wrong. But attempting then to reconcile that view with their sense of the picture on the right creates just the kind of cognitive dissonance that forces students to reconsider their default position on abortion. And the point here is that most university students come to the university with a settled position on abortion. And it takes very, very shocking imagery to induce them to reconsider their position. You've got to unsettle their thinking. And this sort of a display, which has now been exhibited at more than 60 public universities across the country, has the effect of stopping, halting business as usual on a university campus. And a campus that has hardly been thinking about the abortion issue, much less discussing it, suddenly becomes nearly obsessively preoccupied with the issue, and it's nearly all they talk about. University professors who are monolithically pro-abortion bitterly resent the fact that our presence shatters their monopoly on the brokerage of ideas about abortion, and invariably they will come storming up to me and demand to know who gave us permission to set up this display on their campus. And I pause for dramatic effect and say, well, it was Ben Franklin and James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, the founding fathers, the Bill of Rights. They actually think that the free speech is designed to protect their rights, not ours. And they often call the police because very much like some of the progressives and moderates we talked about relative to John Bolton a few moments ago, university professors think it must be against the law to offend them. And we have to explain to them that there actually is no criminal prohibition against our offending them, particularly with the truth. What they really resent is that we are reaching more students in a day than they reach in a year, and long after students have forgotten anything that they hear in a lecture, they're going to remember these pictures. And every time they hear the word abortion, they will recall to mind a very exquisitely formed human embryo or early fetus, eviscerated, disemboweled, etc. And I'd like to say parenthetically something that sort of surprised us because it was an unintended consequence of all of this. Our presence on university campuses is very often either sponsored by or done in informal collaboration with campus ministry groups such as Campus Crusade for Christ or the Navigators, etc. And we have found that these pictures have a very dramatic pre-evangelistic effect on university students, a high percentage of whom think that if there is a God, they're going to be okay with him because they are good people. They'll go to heaven because, after all, they haven't killed anybody until they see these pictures, and then they're given pause to wonder whether perhaps they have killed somebody, whether perhaps they've been complicit in someone's death. And suddenly students who were dismissive of offers of reconciliation with God in the person of Jesus Christ are much, much more open to that possibility. And I've had Campus Crusade staff members around the country tell me that they have had more meaningful conversations with students about Jesus during the 3 or 4 days we were on their campus than they had had during the 3 or 4 years prior to that time. That's an unsolicited testimonial from people who make their living in the calling of witnessing for Christ for university students. At the University of Tennessee, to give you a quantifiable example of the impact of this project from an anecdotal perspective, the director of the local crisis pregnancy center told us that in the 2 weeks next following our time on her campus, at various times, 8 pregnant students came into her center asking for help carrying to term, and all 8 told her they would have killed their babies had they not seen these pictures. And interestingly, all 8 told her they were angry at us for forcing them to look at the pictures, and I told her that I wouldn't lose a moment of sleep over their anger. Because I'm not trying to win a popularity contest. I don't care what people think about me nearly as much as I care what they think about abortion. And if getting them angry at me is the price I have to pay for getting them angry at abortion, that's a price I am fully prepared to pay, and it's a price that I hope you are too. I'm often asked whether this really works, and I can tell you the people on the other side certainly think it works. If you look at this photo from Oregon State University, you will see bed sheets encircling our display, and they've been erected by pro-abortion activists, many of whom came from the Women's Studies program, in an attempt to make the pictures invisible to passers-by, raising the question, if abortion is such a great idea, why do people on the other side not want anybody to see what it is? But the truth is, these folks don't have to follow us around with bed sheets trying to cover up our pictures everywhere we go, because the truth is, the pro-life movement is doing the work for them. The pro-life movement, through self-censorship, has convinced itself that anything we do that upsets or offends anyone is inimical to the interest of the pro-life movement. And so, given the certainty that people don't want to see this imagery, we need to hide it, to cover it up, to suppress it, because if we upset or offend, surely we will fall out of favor and no longer be effective. It's bizarre beyond imagining. Now, this project has been so effective that we enlarged the images yet again, and we began to display them on the sides of box-bodied trucks and the backs of box-bodied trucks, precisely because as we looked at the history of social reform, we discovered that the news media and the entertainment media and the faculties of academic institutions have historically been sympathetic to the causes of reformers, and they were quite willing, these media elites, to publish and broadcast imagery that dramatized injustice, that made injustice impossible to ignore or trivialize, and in the process pricked the collective conscience of the culture, had the sort of impact on public opinion that's required to create the political consensus necessary to change the law. But we don't have the benefit of a sympathetic news media or entertainment media or education establishment. And so it occurred to us that if we were going to get these pictures into the public mind, we needed to create alternative mass media. And that's exactly what a truck is. It is a low-tech, crude, primitive, devastatingly effective alternative mass medium. We took these trucks, a fleet now of some 13 trucks by current count, to the 18 battleground political states during the presidential election last year, as well as a half a dozen U.S. Senate races where there was a pro-life and a pro-abortion candidate squared off. And I don't want to oversell this program by suggesting to you that we believe these trucks are worth 5 or 10 percentage points in a U.S. Senate race, even where you've got a pro-life and a pro-abortion candidate. But I can tell you this. If you're Senator Tom Daschle in South Dakota last October and you're running against John Thune in a race that's going to be decided by about 1 percentage point, you don't want these trucks in your state. You don't want them rolling into your cities. You don't want the press calling you at every stop asking for a reaction to these horrifying pictures while you're trying to change the subject, while you're trying to talk about all of the pork barrel largesse that you have spread around the state of South Dakota You don't want your voters being shown the price that has been paid for that largesse, with the sewers of the cities of South Dakota running red with the blood of your children. You don't want that. And again and again and again, we came into states with these trucks where the pro-life candidate in a Senate race was down, and by Election Day, 5 out of 6 times, the pro-life candidate won in the 6 states in which we were operating these trucks. Why do we think this is critically important? Because if you look at the press coverage on abortion, and you can intuit this without looking at the press coverage, the news media invariably characterizes the positions of pro-abortion candidates as moderate or centrist positions, and the positions of pro-life candidates in terms that suggest a radical or extreme position on abortion. And these pictures tell a very different story regarding which candidates' positions are radical and which candidates' positions are moderate. Now, that project has been so effective that we have enlarged the images yet again, and we are now towing them behind aircraft around the country. But before I tell you more about the aircraft project, I would like to run a brief video clip that is a compilation of television news coverage of this truck project as we ran it through the swing states in the presidential race last year and key U.S. Senate races. And as you watch this, what's significant to bear in mind is that this project is distinctive in the sense that it has forced television news, which is the source on which most Americans rely for their information about the world around them, it has forced television news for the first time to broadcast pictures of aborted babies. That has never happened on any wide scale. And the difficulty for the press is that although they hate to cover pro-life activism, they cannot resist conflict. And these trucks create so much controversy everywhere we take them that the press is unable to resist the temptation to jump into the fray and cover this conflict. But they can't do that without either broadcasting pictures on the sides of the truck, the horrifying aborted baby pictures, in which case, as a predicate to that broadcast, they've got to warn viewers that what they're about to see is going to be disturbing, thereby making our point that abortion is way more disturbing than people might heretofore have imagined. Or in the alternative, if they blur the images out, they've got to explain to viewers why they're blurring them out by disclosing that abortion is too disturbing to show on television, which makes our point either way. So we have boxed the press in and forced television news to do our bidding, and about 50% of the time, on average, they broadcast aborted baby pictures from the sides of our trucks, and the 50% of the time they don't, they make our case for us in any event. May we roll the tape.
L.A., number one choice for news. Fox 11, 10 o'clock news.
The anti-abortion movement hits the road, and it gets closer to you than ever.
Drivers on I-4 got an eyeful today.
The Center for Bioethical Reform hit the interstate this morning during rush hour
with huge 25-foot pictures of aborted fetuses on the sides.
It's an in-your-face message, and it is causing trouble on the freeway.
The pro-life movement takes to a freeway near you. I'm Al Nightfold, the very latest in the anti-abortion movement.
They're on wheels and they're in your face. The pro-life movement is actually driving home a powerful anti-abortion message. And it may catch you off guard next time you're out on the freeway. Now, we have to warn you, some of the pictures you're about to see are disturbing.
We want to warn you, folks, some of these images that you're about to see are disturbing.
Some of the video you're about to see may be disturbing.
Now, we have to warn you, the pictures you're about to see are a bit disturbing.
And we do need to warn you that the video you're about to see in this report is disturbing.
And we caution you, the video we're about to show you may be disturbing.
Now, we want to warn you that some of the images you'll see may be disturbing.
We warn you, some images are graphic.
We want to warn you, though, some of the pictures you're about to see are graphic.
We want to give you ample warning now before you see these images here. They're very graphic.
We warn you, this video is graphic.
We want to warn you, some of these pictures are very graphic.
We want to warn you, they are graphic and you might find them offensive.
And we want to warn you, some of the pictures in this report may be upsetting to some.
We want to warn you, some of the pictures this group uses in its billboard campaign may be upsetting.
The images show an aborted fetus shortly after a procedure posed next to a dime.
They are graphic, they are bloody, and they are doing exactly what the group wants them to do, to turn heads and get people to think.
Oh, that is horrible. But you know what? It makes you think twice about actually doing something like that. It really does.
I'm rather disturbed and disgusted by it because I have a small child. We don't need to see something as disgusting as this.
We're doing what we can to limit the exposure, but we're not going to be part of the cover-up. And there's a cover-up going on. We're being forced to do this because the television won't play it. You won't show the pictures, more than likely.
Now, the pictures on the trucks are far too graphic for us to show.
The pictures on the side of these trucks are too graphic for television.
Channel 9 Eyewitness News has decided not to show you what the group claims are pictures of aborted fetuses.
They're so graphic that we blurred some of the video so you don't need to see it.
It's so disturbing, we can't show you.
27 News made the decision not to show the pictures on the trucks here.
The pictures are so graphic, we've decided not to show them to you.
In fact, the pictures on those billboards are so graphic that we cannot show you the entire truck.
Because of the graphic nature of the pictures, we've blurred them.
To see the complete photographs on these trucks, you'll have to see them in person because we're not going to show them on TV. We're not going to show them on TV.
All right, you may stop the tape. The media
has covered this up.
We're not going to show them on TV.
So this is really the last.
We have... we have hours and hours and hours of this sort of television news clip, and we have compelled television news to give us millions and millions of dollars of free advertising. Advertising that we could never get past the censors if we were to attempt to exhibit these images in paid ads on television. But let me tell you that an airplane towing an aborted baby photo that's 50 feet tall and 100 feet long is also an enormously cost-effective alternative mass medium, not least because our genocide awareness project that we take to university campuses, the outdoor display I just showed you a moment ago, has been blocked from every single private university in the country to which we have attempted to take it. And that includes all of the Ivy League schools and so-called Catholic universities such as Notre Dame, Gonzaga, etc. We can't get onto their campuses. But they don't control the airspace over their campuses. And so we are organizing a private university campus visit with the three aircraft that we now have in operation. And these Ivy Leaguers can run, but they can't hide. Now, let me wind this up by just giving you a very, very quick litany of imagery from the history of social reform as a reminder of how social reform has worked historically in this country. Even before there were cameras, there were artists who were depicting slavery in terms that were very, very influential in helping people understand the brutality of slavery and helping people understand that slavery was not the benign institution that these kinds of propaganda etchings were designed to suggest. And when the camera did come into play, it revealed devastating imagery of the horrors of slavery, as well as Jim Crow, with black people being forced to use segregated waiting rooms, water fountains, movie theaters, schools, restrooms. Here you have a white people's restroom behind which there is a colored dining room in the same privy. And if black people resisted these Jim Crow laws, they were lynched. Some of you are familiar with the Emmett Till story, a young boy who was brutally murdered in Mississippi, and his mother insisted that he have an open casket funeral in Chicago. And these two photos were published side by side in the Chicago Defender and Jet magazine, and many of the giants of the civil rights movement later reported that it was these two pictures, Emmett Till in life and Emmett Till in death, the contrast between the two, that galvanized in their mind the sense that segregation had become so evil that it had to be stopped. Here with Emmett Till's mother, here's the Birmingham church bombing with the four little girls whose lives were taken, a sanitation workers' strike with the sanitation workers carrying a poster that says, "I am a man," which was the very issue that was in dispute then, and it's the very issue that's in dispute today about unborn children. Desegregation of schools in Little Rock, Arkansas. These were embarrassing photographs of National Guard troops and federal troops who had to surround these young black people to get them into schools on the theory that separate but equal may have been separate, but it certainly wasn't equal, even at the university system. Nobody wanted to see these pictures of freedom riders being hauled off of buses and savagely beaten, of black people trying to register to vote and being beaten in the process. These were pictures that Martin Luther King said we will use to shame America before the world. And indeed, that was exactly the impact that the pictures had. And they created an impact on public opinion that created the political consensus that was required. Here, black people trying to swim in the ocean, for heaven's sake, and being driven away. The consensus that racism was a cancer on society and unworthy of a great nation. Here you have racists attacking a news photographer after they became sophisticated enough to realize that the camera was their greatest enemy. They would not attack black people until after they had attacked the cameraman and destroyed their camera equipment, so no record of the brutalization could be made. And we, of course, saw the incredible power of horrifying imagery in the Rodney King beating, and the list goes on and on. Photos that were designed to create sympathetic depictions of the sacrifices African Americans were making for this country in all of our wars, down through the war in Vietnam. But the press, very often being anti-war, would use this sort of imagery, here American soldiers in life, then American soldiers in death, to shape public opinion, here with the My Lai massacre, victims in life, victims in death, to create the impression that the war was being corruptly fought, incompetently fought, that the South Vietnamese government no longer had the support of the South Vietnamese people, that our allies had contempt for the rule of law, that even in the United States, civilians were paying a terrible price here at Kent State. And this steady drumbeat of very, very horrifying imagery was enormously effective in negatively influencing public opinion about the Vietnam War, as is the case today with the war in Iraq. Here, USA Today, with 1 month's war dead in life. And again, this steady drumbeat of imagery suggesting we're losing the war in Iraq. The criticism you're most likely to hear of our project is that young children are going to see these pictures and as a consequence be traumatized by them. I commend to your consideration the photo on the left of the Oklahoma City bombing, whose 10th anniversary was yesterday. You have a dead baby girl, 2 years old, on the left, fractured skull, a fireman cradling her dead body. Millions of young children in this country saw that picture and were disturbed by it, but parents accepted that reality because they realized that for democracy to flourish, we require good journalism, and good journalists don't cover up horrifying stories because some stories are too horrifying to tell through the written or spoken word. You've got to see the pictures. But when we display the picture of the baby on the right, suddenly the rules change. And I would argue that the rules change because the picture on the left does not evoke feelings of guilt among very many parents, but the picture on the right does. And you can't go to the grocery store today or open the newspaper in your home without seeing horrifying imagery that is disturbing little children. Here in Iraq, the brains of two election workers being blown out, the covers of magazines showing, as well as newspapers, very, very disturbing imagery. And we accept this and the influence it has on little children, airliners exploding into skyscrapers, as the price that has got to be paid for a vibrant democracy, unless, again, the imagery that is being shown relates to abortion. And then, again, suddenly the rules change. Journalists were very open about trying to shape public opinion as regards the tsunami death toll, to mobilize support to help victims by displaying these very, very shocking pictures. The last thing I'm going to say to you, and the point on which I'm going to stop this morning, is simply this. My wife is a public health nurse who founded and directed two of this country's first crisis pregnancy medical clinics. We are strong, strong supporters of crisis pregnancy work. But I must tell you, the overwhelming majority of women in crisis pregnancy in this country do not go to the crisis pregnancy center. They go to the abortion clinic because they don't want help getting through a crisis pregnancy. They want help getting out of a crisis pregnancy. And that's not going to change until we convince these young women that their baby is in fact a baby during the first 90 days of pregnancy and that abortion is indeed an indefensible act of violence which kills that baby. And every political objective we want to accomplish, every economic objective, encouraging consumers to make economic decisions in defense of life, hinges on our ability to convince the American people that this is a baby and that taking his life is an indefensible act of violence. You do that using visual imagery. That's going to cost us something. And tragically, every horrifying thing we've seen this morning as regards abortion is happening with the permission of the body of Christ. Because God has given his people dominion over resources more than adequate to stop this. But last year, Emily's List, the pro-abortion political action committee, raised and spent $34 million on congressional campaigns in support of pro-abortion candidates. The National Right to Life Committee, the biggest pro-life political action committee, raised and spent $1.7 million. $34 million versus $1.7 million. You want to know why we're losing this thing? We're losing this thing because the people who are determined to kill these babies are way more committed than the people who say they oppose abortion. And I've asked myself why, and here's the thought with which I want to leave you this morning. St. Thomas More, on the eve of his execution in the Tower of London, wrote a reflection that asked the very interesting question, who was on the night of Christ's arrest, on the evening prior to his crucifixion, who was the apostle who was most faithful to his master? And it's a trick question because the answer is Judas Iscariot. While the church was sound asleep, while the apostles couldn't even stay awake through the travail of Christ, Judas was up, he was animated, he was energized, he had a plan, and he was doing the evil bidding of his master. And 2,000 years later, very little has changed. The church is sleepwalking through an atrocity that we have the power to stop. We know how to stop it, and it's not being stopped because it's not the priority for us that it should be. God bless you, and thank you for allowing me to be here.